First case in our calendar is 95-2558, Paul Sparks and Christopher Ramsey versus State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company. Mr. Pritchard.
Good morning. Chief Justice, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. My name is Glenn Pritchard. I represent Paul Sparks, who is the administrator of the estate of Kelly Ramsey. I'm sure it seems to the court at this time that no matter how hard the court works, we seem to keep messing up the area of uninsured motorist coverage. And certainly there isn't any area of uninsured motorist coverage that is more messed up than the issue of, in a wrongful death case, who is entitled to make the claim under the policies of the deceased or the policies of the individual beneficiaries themselves.
Let's start there, Mr. Pritchard, because we know the facts, and except for a moment that I understand your argument of the contract versus tort, and that you're really bringing this on a contract claim. I have not missed the point you've made. I want to, this is going to sound like it, maybe. Why did you not make an additional claim against the tortfeasor's remaining $200,000 in this policy when we have said that each person in a wrongful death action, beneficiaries who are presumed to have had damage and have a separate cause of action? Why would you not have proceeded against the tortfeasor's policy?
Because frankly, it was not clear at that time that there was uninsured motorist coverage available, although I was not the attorney of record at the time. This case was settled with the tortfeasor. This accident occurred in August 1992, well before the Savoy decision. And at that time, it certainly was everybody was under the impression that under the liability side of the policies anyway, that all that was available for wrongful death claims was the per person limit of liability, and we were not entitled to get into the split limit of liability under the policy.
What case has ever said that?
Prior to Wood v. Shepherd, Hill v. Allstate,
Hill versus Wood, Allstate didn't involve the liability section of the policy, did it?
Right, for the uninsured motorist coverage.
Uninsured motorist coverage is different than liability.
It is different from the liability coverage. The cases are escaping me about limiting the purpose of the liability.
The reason they escape all of us, as you started out, is because we confuse uninsured with underinsured. You, several times in your brief, call this, which leads me to the next question, uninsured motorist coverage. This tortfeasor wasn't uninsured, was he?
It's an underinsured claim.
Underinsured claim. Well, yes. Then we shouldn't be calling it an uninsured claim, should we?
You should be naming that.
Okay. So, your clients really moved under the underinsured portion of their State Farm policy to recover what they had not been paid.
Right?
Let me tell you the reason I'm asking you, maybe you want to address it, maybe you won't. It seems to me, under this modern-day world, supposing that the fiduciary of this state was the surviving spouse of the decedent and was a second marriage, and the second marriage was not very happy with the children who are your clients. Your statement in your brief specifically says that when the fiduciary signs a release, you recognize that the fiduciary releases all the claims of the next of kin in the tort action. Now, can that be accurate?
In the tort action, I think it is accurate.
If that's accurate and the fiduciary can release it, it can release everybody's claim, then all that's left is the contract action. Is that right?
All that is left is a contract action, assuming the beneficiaries are covered by some policy as a lender.
Yeah, in this case.
Right, the court action against the tortfeasor can be brought by and settled only by the fiduciary.
Do the next of kin have any control over the fiduciary and what the fiduciary might do with the settlement of the case?
Only to the extent that they have access to the probate court. The probate court exercises jurisdiction to make sure that everybody is listed who's supposed to be a beneficiary, and everybody has an opportunity to appear in the probate court to exercise some control and to have a hearing about how that money is distributed.
So your answer with regard to why you didn't try to access the other 200 when there were separate claims is that you felt that the case law or whoever was involved in it at the time said that there can only be a single policy limit against the tortfeasor's policy.
No, certainly the case at the time of this settlement, it was certainly the common way things were done at the time of the settlement. The tortfeasor in this case, which was in December of 1992, although the court made it clear to everyone that we were mistaken about that, State Farm offered $100,000 as settlement, as policy limits, as exhaustion of the liability coverage. And the plaintiffs in that case certainly accepted it in as $100,000 as the full policy limits and as exhaustion of the policy, because everybody, I think it's fair to say that everybody at that time was under the impression that the liability policies, the purpose of the limit of liability, was all that could be obtained in an uninsured number in a wrongful death case.
And that brings us, Mr. Pritchard, to the argument that's made by your adversary here, that under Peerless, you know, you can't have both ways. What do you say to that argument about the, not even though you were under the impression, things changed. Savoy changed some things, and now can you have the right to recover for each person and not have to exhaust the policy limits?
I think parties are certainly entitled to agree what exhaustion is, and I think that the court cases do not automatically say you have to get 100% of the dollar. And State Farm was a party to the settlement in this case. And if State Farm says, I'm giving you $100,000 as exhaustion, and the plaintiffs and insurers say that I'm accepting $100,000 as exhaustion, then it's exhaustion. And the party should be stopped from coming back at a later time and saying that it isn't exhaustion. But really, the issue that causes all the problems in this case is the release in this case, because Paula Sparks is the administratrix of the estate of Kelly Ramsey, did sign a release in favor of not only the tortfeasor in this case, but also of State Farm. Because the thing that makes this case a little bit more interesting than your average case is that State Farm was not only the liability carrier, but also the uninsured motorist carrier. And that's why there are some interesting issues in this case that you won't find in others.
Would it make any difference to your argument if they had been different?
They would be different. I would not have taken this case because of the subrogation clause, which is the first thing that I wanted to get to, was that if the tortfeasor had been released without the permission of the uninsured motorist carrier, then there would have been a violation, an instruction of the subrogation rights of the uninsured motorist carrier. But in this case, it makes a difference.
How can a fiduciary destroy the rights of beneficiaries or next of kin who have no control over what the fiduciary is going to do with, in this case, the carrier?
Well, that's a really good question. First of all, I would like to argue that State Farm didn't have any subrogation rights, or more specifically, the insureds didn't have any subrogation rights, because the power to make a settlement and the power to preserve subrogation rights were vested with the administrator of the estate and did not vest with the named insureds. Nevertheless, there are some cases that have held that the administrator can destroy the subrogation rights. And at most, I think the thing that can be said about that is that perhaps the insurer would at least have a duty to go to the insurance company if the insurer knew about the settlement and say, look, the administrator is about to make a settlement here. I don't have total control over there. What do you want me to do? I think maybe under the cooperation clauses of the policy, that's the most the insurer can do under that situation, because the individual insurer really is powerless. Not totally powerless. Like I said, they can make an appearance in the probate court. But whatever it was that the insurers could do, should do, have to do under the policy, it's pretty clear that it wasn't necessary in this case, because the settlement was State Farm's idea. State Farm had an obligation to try to secure a release for its insurer, who was also the tortfeasor. And therefore, to the extent that State Farm was in on the deal, that it was their idea, they certainly consented to the settlement. And therefore, the subrogation clause was not violated in this case. And that's why it makes a difference in this particular case, is because State Farm consented to this settlement.
Did I read somewhere where they drew up the release?
State Farm provided the release.
Try just one more question, Mr. Pritchard. If we take your position that this case is different because the same carrier represents both your clients and the tortfeasor, then haven't we just contributed by creating a yet another special exception to what you started out your argument with, that it's so confusing that nobody understands it? Now we're going to say there's an exception to the exception, that in fact, if you have the same carrier in these situations, then there's recovery under contract, but if you don't, there isn't? What privity is there between the beneficiary? The beneficiaries obviously have privity with their own carrier. What privity does the fiduciary have with the carrier of the beneficiaries?
None. There is no privity there. And as I said before, the holding in this case should be that the uninsured motorist insurers do not have the rights that need to be protected under the subrogation clause. And I think that that's the starting point. And if the insurers have an obligation under the policy, it isn't certainly, as we would typically understand, is a protection of subrogation rights, because they just don't have that power. And if there are some other actions that the insurers need to take, then the insurance company needs to advise them of that action and taking it into the probate court. In any event, when the settlement with the tortfeasor was consummated, there were no instructions by State Farm, and, you know, don't take that, because we have subrogation rights against our own insurer, which, as I argued in my brief, I think is a little crazy in and of itself, that State Farm is claiming that it has subrogation rights against its own insurer to begin with. But the release also created some other difficulties about whether or not, and I think that this really gets into another case that the court is going to hear today, the Holt versus Grain case, about whether the release itself released the underinsured motorist claim. And it's undisputed that the release was signed not by the individual named insurer under the State Farm policy, but was signed only by the administrators of the deceased estate in that capacity. And I don't think that there's any dispute about that. Nevertheless, State Farm is taking the position that release, because it included State Farm, also released all of the individual beneficiaries under insured motorist claims. And that really gets into the issue that is going to be presented in the Holt case that is coming up. And oddly enough, I think that I never thought I'd be in a position where OACTA and Grain Insurance Company would be advancing my position, because in the Holt case, the OACTA and Grain Insurance Company is making exactly this argument. They're saying, look, the uninsured motorist claim is a contract claim. It's not a court claim. And to the extent that a beneficiary is not an insured under the decedent's policy, there's no privity of contract between the beneficiary and the uninsured motorist carrier, and that non-insured beneficiary ought not be able to make a claim under the decedent's policy. And I say right up to the point, that it's clear from the holdings of this case that an insurance policy is a contract. An uninsured motorist claim is a matter of contract. And therefore, when Paula Sparks signed that release in her capacity as the administrator of the estate, she didn't have the power to release the underinsured motorist claims of the individual beneficiaries who did not sign that release.
What is she releasing as a personal representative? What is she releasing as to State Farm?
She was releasing the tort claim against the tortfeasor, and apparently, insurance companies do this all the time in just purely tort claims. They put the insurance company's name on the release too, because they're the one paying the check for the tortfeasor. So I don't know what theory would allow the claimant to bring a direct action against the liability carrier, but they always throw the insurer of the liability of the tortfeasor, always throws his name on the release too, and that's exactly what happened here.
The reason I was concerned about whether or not we want to make an exception, an effect of the exception, is because the case you referred to is going to be argued later, is Holt versus Grange Mutual. And on page 5 of their brief, at the footnote, they say the adult sons of Holt arguably could have pursued Sexton type claims under their own respective policies.
Right.
And you don't have the same insurer there of the tortfeasor and the beneficiaries are Mexican.
Well, that's okay. I mean, the answer is going to be the same. And I don't mean to confuse the those rights get preserved may vary in this case a little bit because they happen to be a party to the release, but I'm assuming in the whole case that that they went through the additional step of whatever they needed to do to make sure that the uninsured motorist carriers at least knew about the pending settlement if that was a requirement under the policy, and in that way gave the uninsured motorist carrier the opportunity to protect its subrogation rights. The I see that I am
you've used your time. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Mr. Gallagher.
Has a separate cause of action. One is Savoy. Wood versus Shepherd decided that in wrongful death cases.
Wood versus Shepherd decided that with underinsured motorist coverage, each beneficiary has a separate cause of action.
Right.
But the Wood versus Allstate case was also a factor saying that the limits of liability coverage and the limits of the underinsured people didn't trigger that claim. So that's, those are two cases that
we have. Do you concede as of today whether it happened just pre-Wood or post-Wood, or whether it happened pre-Hill or post-Hill, you can see today that every next of kin under 212502 has a separate cause of action and are presumed to have suffered damage. Is that what the statute says?
No, Your Honor. I think the way it goes is that under Wood versus Shepherd case, it said that each beneficiary has a separate cause of action. In your Savoy decision, you said the same, so long as they were presumed to be damaged. But then we had a change in decision of all of Senate Bill 20 from October 1994 to the following. So I'll give you a blanket agreement. I guess it depends on when the cost of that. This, that issue flip flop back and forth.
But you don't think the statute says that that each next of kin has is presumed to have suffered damage individually?
I think the wrong best statute, 212502, says that the parents, spouse, and children are presumed to have suffered damage, but doesn't say anything about the claims. It doesn't address anything about the claims. The wrong best statute simply says they're presumed to have suffered damage in the absence of any evidence.
In the absence of what?
Any evidence of the contrary. That's all the wrong best statute says.
Okay, so these two beneficiaries, did they suffer damage? They had to, pursuant to the statute.
Pursuant to the statute, they did, and they, okay. In fact, they were paid $100,000, so we assumed it.
They were paid $100,000, or the estate was?
The estate was. The estate wasn't paid anything. Your Honor, and maybe that's a clarification you ought to make right now. Not yet, and I, at the first part of our brief, I want to address this because there is some confusion, I think, in the courts regarding this issue. The administrator of the estate has two hats they wear, and they are completely separate. Number one, the administrator of the estate acts on behalf of the decedent. So to preserve any cause of action the decedent has, like survivor action, selling their house, anything of that nature. And when the administrator is wearing that hat, he's got all the rights.
rights of the deceased. There can be no greater, there can be no worse than applying to the estate. But when we're talking about the wrongful death statute, Your Honor, that has absolutely nothing to do with the estate. Because the wrongful death statute says it's for the exclusive benefit of the next of kin and the beneficiaries, not the estate. And the wrongful death proceeds can't be attached by debtors who are trying to make claims against the estate.
Does the fiduciary have the cause of action for the pain and suffering? The deceased?
On behalf
of the survivor. Does, a survivorship.
On behalf of the survivor, that's a completely separate statute.
Well, okay, so what if the survivor statute, the $100,000 was paid for the survivorship claim?
But it wasn't, Your Honor. The evidence in this case shows that the full $100,000 was paid as a wrongful death claim.
From the release?
Well, from the release and from the probate, they determined it was attributed to the survivor, to Mrs. Sparks. So we don't have a survivor fund in this case. We don't have anything to prove on behalf of the estate. We have an administrator who, pursuant to the Neiman versus Ramsey case, is acting as the representative of the Mexican. And the only thing that person is doing is acting as a representative of the Mexican. And according to the Burwell versus Maynard case by the Ohio Supreme Court 20 years ago, it says that everything that the administrator does in asserting this wrongful death case is binding on every one of those next of kin. And as a ratio to cause that, then they are bound by a general release just as if they had signed it. Okay? That's the effect we have. And there's been absolutely no litigation on that issue for 20 years, 30 years. That's Burwell versus Maynard. The court said back in 1939 in the Douglas versus Daniel Brothers Holcomb case that the beneficiaries are the real party of interest when you're talking about wrongful death. And the money goes directly to them. It has nothing to do with the estate. It doesn't get distributed according to the will. It's their claim. The only thing the legislature is doing is when they told the administrator to also assert a cause of action as a representative of the next of kin, they're trying to keep somebody that had 20 family members who filed 20 lawsuits.
Was it necessary here to get the probate court's approval of the settlement?
Absolutely.
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 But if it doesn't have anything to do with the estate, why does it have to have probate court approval?
Because according to 21.2501 21.2502, it states that the probate court has to approve it.
Exactly. Because it's a wrongful death claim on behalf of the estate as well.
No, it's not the estate. Doesn't have a wrongful death claim.
Yeah, I understand that. Pursuant to statute, it doesn't.
No, the statute specifically says that the claim is for the exclusive benefit of the next of kin.
I just agreed with you.
Okay. Your Honor, the question was, what could these beneficiaries have done? You know, here they are, the administrator signs the release, and now they put down what happened. This is a totally irresolvable problem. Well, it's not. It's not at all. And the reason for that is this. Say that the administrator is just a family attorney. It's not even a family member. And they assert the wrongful death cause of action for all the family members. And they get an offer of $100,000. Well, according to the procedure that is followed, is they have to notify the next of kin, I have an offer of $100,000. We are going to have a hearing before the probate court. At that point, we're going to ask the court to approve that settlement. If you object in any way to that settlement, or if you have any concerns, please come and voice them before the probate court. If they do that, it's home protection. The probate court, if they come in and they say, Your Honor, I've got an underinsured motorcycle claim potentially, I want to divide my health carrier with potential settlement, see if the waiver segregation rights, could you wait until I do that? Of course the probate court's going to do it. And that's what happens every single day in Ohio. That's why there's no litigation on this issue.
Does the carrier have any obligation to the insured to tell them exactly what you just did? Warn them that you may have an underinsured motorist claim before you settle with the tortfeasor. There are certain things that the company asks you or requests you to do, and make sure you do them before you settle with the tortfeasor.
Your Honor, this court stated in the case of Logan versus Ramsey that the insurers had to be not to sign the release or to have the rights released without seeking permission of the insured motorist carrier. So state law right now says the insurers do to obtain consent from their own carrier if they want to sign the release or have their rights released.
It's not my question, though. Does the insurance company have a duty to their insured to make sure that they understand through the contract that they have to do these things before they settle with the tortfeasor.
Yes, well, the State Farm's contract says that. State Farm's contract does tell them, Your Honor, that they have the duty to preserve their rights, and they shall.
Okay, so there's no talking between the insurance company and the insured. It's just that read the contract, and if you don't read the contract, it's your fault. Is that what you're saying? Yes. Is there any obligation on the insurance company to make sure they're insured who has an uninsured motorist claim potential understands that they do have this and to be careful in settling with the tortfeasor? Do they have any obligation to tell them that verbally?
I don't think they do.
They do not.
I don't think they do, Your Honor. I think that the insurers are represented by their own counsel, who are getting paid $33,000 in this particular case, to advise their clients as to what the rights are under their own.
What if you don't have counsel?
But they did in this case, Your Honor.
Well, what if you don't?
If they're going to act without counsel,
At their own peril.
Okay. If they're going to act without counsel and have a contract that says don't sign a release without permission, then I think they have to be bound by that release. No, I don't think State Farm or any insurance company has the duty to advise the insurers of what their rights are in all policies.
Okay.
Is the position, is State Farm taking a position here that the subrogation, that the failure to comply with the subrogation clause in the insurance policy, that, you know, Paul Sparks policy, is the problem here?
We're taking the position that there's no coverage for three reasons. Let me summarize that. Number one, as you were indicating, now that based on the law of the time of the settlement, $100,000 was a problem, was it? The plaintiff's attorney in this case made a mistake. Based on the law at that time, Cincinnati versus Phillips and Thomas versus Solomon, Three Farm versus Rose, all those cases, $100,000 was otherwise. And they accepted the $100,000. When Savoy came out, all of a sudden that expanded the insurance coverage available, and they tried to take Savoy back in time, a year and a half, to say, hey, wait a minute, underinsured motorist coverage to your excess, and it's multiple limits.
They took the $100,000 on the premise that that was coming from the tortfeasor's policy.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is this. The first syllable of Savoy also has to travel back in time. And the first syllable of Savoy said that there was $300,000 in liability coverage available. And they had the duty to exhaust the liability insurance before they can trigger underinsured motorist coverage. So if we're going to take Savoy back, syllables 2 and 4, saying your excess is global limits, and we also have to take syllables 1 back.
But counsel makes the argument that estoppel could well work here in terms of... you're back to the exhaustion argument, and I understand that. But I'm curious about, is it your position that because State Farm was an additional releasee in that form, and coincidentally being the same carrier, that bound this particular, on the other contract that this party had, that bound her on her contract? And it's really a coincidence that we have the same carrier. Is that the position you're taking?
Your Honor, that would be important.
Yeah.
That would be my point.
I don't see that in your brief, but sounds like that's what you're
arguing. Number one is this. Again, there's $300,000 liability coverage available. They got $100,000. They did it themselves. You're going to say, based on the new law, there actually was more coverage on the underinsured side. You also have to take some way back and say there's actually $300,000 available for liability coverage. And they got $100,000 out of $300,000, and that's certainly not an exhaustion they have to pay for. The second thing I'm saying is this. By the time they asserted their underinsured motorist claims for the first time, it was after all the settlement had already gone by. It was a year after they had asked the probate court to fully and finally assure the settlement. All right, now by that time, the policy and the statute requires that the insurers be, quote, legally entitled to collect. Well, at that time, were they legally entitled to collect? Absolutely not. Why weren't they legally entitled to collect from the tortfeasor? Because with their consent, they allowed the administrator of the estate to sign a release in favor of the tortfeasor. And it's binding on them. So second offense, They're not legally entitled to the policy.
But is finding on them as to what, as to which defendant? State Farm or the, I forget the tort fees or something.
No, Your Honor, the policy and the statute says that in order to make an underinsured motorist claim, you have to be legally entitled to collect from the tort fees. Well, when they asserted their claim in 1993, were they legally entitled to collect from the tort fees? No, they weren't. Because the tort fees has a full, complete defense. They were released. And that's the release we're talking about, the release of the tort fees. The tort, they had actually no right. There was a case called State Farm versus Webb by this court, where it says underinsured motorist carriers have a right to assert the exact same defenses that are available in the tort fees. And so when they came, they said, by the way, we now want to make an underinsured motorist claim. State Farm said, you release the tort fees. You have no right to collect against them. Therefore, you have no right to collect against us. You are bound by this release of the tort fees. The third issue is the subrogation clause. The insurance has the duty to protect subrogation. They can't sign a release in favor of the tort fees without asking permission. Here, number one, they didn't assert the claim. Number two, they didn't ask permission. Number three, they signed the release.
But now, counsel, this is where it's a little hard to swallow, isn't it? Because we're talking about the same, I mean, the same entity. The arguments made by the appellant that, gee whiz, you say they didn't ask for permission, yet they're right in the thick of it, paying money.
They paid money on the premise that there was only one claim, which they can't ask the money.
Right.
Has somebody come back and said, by the way, there's actually...
And hence the release could be the same. You could make that same argument about the release. They were paying the relief. They were releasing the tortfeasor and State Farm as to the claims on that policy.
Well, the release is much broader than that, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
The release is much broader than that.
I get that. And is that only a matter of coincidence? I mean, that if it were...
Be.
Sure.
It could be.
And
but
how could...
But it could be, Your Honor, but the one last coincidence, I'll say this. Because in this particular case, the administrator of the estate and the person coming to you today trying to get more money is the same person also. And when she comes in and says, how could I, what control do I have with the administrator? She wants the administrator.
But that really gets us back to Justice Sweeney's question. What duty, especially in an instance like this, when the insurance company is the same insurance for both the tortfeasor and plaintiff in this case,
and
you stand before us and talk about subrogation and all of these things, and the insurance company is the one writing the release, and then you say it isn't in there, why isn't in there? They prepared it.
Yeah, Your Honor, I go back to the fact that at the time of settlement this case, the yellow money that they were entitled to was informed by the law, so it wasn't in the council money. The attorney didn't do anything wrong, it wasn't in the coverage. They settled it from the law change to try to keep money, and the problem was not a case of trade for the general public interest. It's the only case I'm aware of.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher. Mr. Pritchard, you use your time, but take 30 seconds.
Regarding the exhaustion requirement, the parties certainly agreed, and Mr. Gallagher just said that $100,000 was all that was available at the time. So at the time, this was exhaustion. Both parties agreed that it was being exhausted. Both parties agreed it was exhausted, then it's exhausted.
But what about his argument that if you want to take the other parts of the boy back, you have to take the $300,000 back, and therefore you really have not exhausted it anymore?
I agree that you take the whole decision back, but be that as it may, the parties to the contract can reach their own bargain no matter what the law happens to be. And at the time that this settlement...
So you're saying that even though they only paid $100,000 and they had $300,000 available over that period, they can still go ahead after the company for under insurance? I don't follow that.
Since State Farm was a party to the settlement with the tort user, and State Farm agreed that $100,000 used up, that's the word used in the exhaustion clause in the State Farm policy, used up the liability coverage, and State Farm agreed to that at the time, and they said that this is $100,000, it uses up all of the liability coverage, and the plaintiff says, well, okay, I'm going to take $100,000 because it uses up all the tort user's coverage. Then the parties agree that it's exhaustion, and the parties in the contract trying to comply with the contractual requirement are allowed to reach an agreement among themselves about what exhaustion means.
But the parties don't agree that under insurance is exhausted also because there's a match at that point.
I don't understand what...
So you're trying to say the parties made this agreement, but then you want to change the void law and say all this other stuff changed, but not not this part because it doesn't benefit us.
No, I think, I'm willing to take it all back. I'm willing to say that at the time, that you're entitled to take it back. But what I am saying is that the parties can agree about what exhaustion is and whether there has been exhaustion in the case.
And did the parties agree there was no under insurance claim also? They never filed one.
Well, the parties didn't talk about that at all. And even though the parties went to claim with the State Farm and say, we have our own State Farm policies, and we want you to tell us whether or not there's any overlapping coverage, they came back and they say that $100,000 is all the coverage that was available.
Based on the law of the time.
Based on the law of the time.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.